Welcome, William Evans here, and you are listening to a Living World Conversation with Barbara Dills. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you, Will. I'm so pleased to be here.
Kindly tell us who you are.
Boy, when you get to be 73, that becomes a challenging question.
Yeah, briefly.
Okay. Well, I'm a resident of Carbondale. I live up on Missouri Heights now with my two adopted Mustangs, a dog and a cat, and occasionally my son and his girlfriend. And I came to Carbondale in late 2011 from Oregon, where I had lived in a variety of different communities, but for a while along the Columbia River, which I know is one of the things we're going to talk about today.
Right. And at age 21 in 1974, you accepted an invitation from your boyfriend and drove your red used VW Bug to the Rosebud Lakota Reservation and spent the summer there cooking. And in the way of a surprise, you began to heal.
That's correct. The Rosebud Reservation is in South Central South Dakota, which was sounded very exotic to a young woman who had grown up in New England from good old New England stock. And 3 weeks after I graduated from college, I was driving out there alone to meet up with my boyfriend who had gone ahead of me. You know, I really didn't have any noble purpose. I thought I was going to have a freewheeling romantic summer with my new beau, and I didn't realize I was headed for an armed American Indian Movement camp and a life among very traditional Lakota people who ultimately welcomed me, and I was able to share in their daily life and in their ceremonies, and the daily life involved a lot of cooking.
And indirectly healing for you.
Right. I mean, I think most of us at 21 don't know that we need to be healed. We just want to run away from our parents, which is sort of what I was running away from my dad's expectations of me after college. Yeah, I don't think I really thought in terms of I need healing, although I'd been studying a lot of different spiritual traditions. That was my interest. But I didn't think of it so much in terms of my own situation. And as it turned out, I realized as I went through some of these ceremonies that there was a lot in there that needed to be looked at.
And you took root in a culture very different from the world you'd grown up in.
For sure. As I say, I was kind of from a good old New England family. And, to be among people who were still practicing or attempting to, you know, preserve and protect their very ancient culture was eye-opening.
And would it be accurate to say metaphorically, you acquired new eyes?
Definitely acquired new eyes. I think that's a really good way to put it.
And then you left Rosebud and spent time in Oregon.
I did.
And eventually moved to Hood River.
That's right. I lived in Oregon two different times. I moved there first. At the end of the summer of 1974, where I had been in Rosebud, because my brother had just taken a high school teaching position there, and I could crash in his house, basically.
And you moved to Hood River, and by about 1983, you were seeing the Columbia River with your new eyes.
That's true. So I and lived in Hood River, had my own little cabin and lived in Hood River. By that time I had a child and he was just 2 going on 3. And as I was there and began to notice the native people along the river, I saw, and then I started to learn about the fishing rights struggles there of those people. I started to understand their struggle to maintain their connection to the river and the salmon as very parallel to what I had learned among the Lakota about their history with the buffalo.
And the music which opened this conversation is about the ways of the people on the Columbia River at Celilo. Kindly tell us about this music.
Well, that music was actually co-written by 2 people, and I can't pronounce the first person's name, but Marv Ross was the genius behind this beautiful play, The Ghosts of Celilo. And Marv Ross, for those of you who go back in rock and roll history, was actually one of the principals in the band Quarter Flash, he and his wife Mindy. But later on, he became quite a composer, and he had written and composed music for this quite amazing play, The Ghosts of Celilo, which addressed the inundation of Celilo Falls and its impact on the community. So that's where the music comes from. It comes from the musical play, which was performed by a mixed cast of non-natives and people from around the area who were very connected to the river. So it was a very moving and beautiful play. I think it was produced in 2011, if I remember right.
And you, before I ask you that, you acknowledge the parallels between the Lakota people in the plains and the buffalo and the people of the Columbia River and the salmon. And the tribes of indigenous people living on the Columbia River perfected a system of harvest regulation for an enormous watershed, which allowed a return of 10 to 16 million fish per year for 10,000 years.
Their ethic was only to take what they needed. And when commercial fisheries became established by non-native people, it was a whole concept they couldn't understand and they didn't appreciate very much. And then when the cannery was invented and a cannery was established in the Dalles, which is right the largest settlement of non-native people right near Celilo Falls, then the decimation of the salmon runs really increased.
And this salmon run didn't just feed the people where you were. It went all the way up into Canada, all of Idaho, much of Montana, much of Washington and Oregon, even small parts of Wyoming and Utah and Nevada. There were salmon that came up that mouth of the Columbia.
That's right. And the Dalles, pre-colonization, the Dalles was a main meeting place of different tribes. Even people from the plains would go all that way and trade different things for the shells for ornation and for the salmon and
right.
Dry it and take it back. And they would bring, buffalo. So there was a whole exchange of goods that happened at the Dalles for probably centuries.
Maybe at Celilo.
Right. Well, at Celilo is where the fishing would take place.
That's where the people were.
That's where the village was. But actually the Dalles, the history of the Dalles, because I don't know what the word Dalles actually means, but the land actually opens up there. So there was space for people to gather.
Okay.
But the Dalles is only about, 8 miles from the Celilo village. So those were totally connected.
But the population there was huge. I've seen estimates that, the population there was 10,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
So maintaining such a balance for thousands of years was not an accident.
No, it's how they lived to be in harmony with the earth and in gratitude for the river and all that it produced.
So a population of, strong, healthy people were intentionally living in balance with a gift of a healthy, strong salmon run.
Which depended on a healthy river, of course. Right.
Source water.
Yeah, the source water.
They were all partaking of source water. The people, the salmon, and they honored source.
Absolutely, in their ceremonies and just in their daily lives.
So perception is the power to see what is in fact there and to participate in a conversation with the gift.
And so there, that was their perception for sure, was participation with the gift.
And they knew they'd been given a gift.
Absolutely. I mean, it's in all the ceremonies that are still practiced today. A very important one being the first food ceremonies.
Yeah, and you witnessed that ceremony.
And participated, yeah.
Yeah, and the first food ceremony, the salmon ceremony, was conducted. It was a conversation with the sacred gift of salmon and the berries of that season on the river.
And, you know, I had a clarification in sort of preparing for this interview that that there was a second first food ceremony for the berries later in the year, because actually the huckleberries ripen more like in August. And the salmon run starts usually in more like April, early April. So, yes, I attended and participated in the salmon first food ceremony at Celilo Falls in their longhouse, which they still maintain. And the ethos of those first food ceremonies is that while you can fish before the first spring food ceremony, nobody actually eats any salmon until this ceremony has occurred. Anyway, I can say more about that maybe later on when we're talking about some of the people in particular, but it's a very powerful thing to imagine people coming out of winter, probably hungry, having, you know, maybe depleted their store of dried salmon from the year before, and they're out there working really hard to fish and bring fish in to share with the people, but nobody cooks or eats any of it until this first food ceremony has occurred.
And their self-control is driven by a spirit of community.
Yes, community and gratitude, I think, yeah. And I was just going to say, too, that my recollection of those first food ceremonies I attended at Celilo is that, I mean, you're sitting in these long, 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 low tables on the ground in the longhouse, hundreds of people, before any of the food is honored one thing at a time and then eaten for the first time that season. The water is drunk and the water is blessed, because everything else depends on the water. The people,
water is life.
The people, the salmon, the roots, the berries, the wildlife, the deer, the elk, all of it depends on the water. So the water is the first thing. And everybody raises a cup at the same moment, and a prayer is said.
And what do they say? Oh, you.
Well,
do?
There's a word. They always say "shush" when they drink water, but I don't remember the rest of the.
So a gift is a thing we don't get by our own efforts. We can't buy it. We can't acquire it through an act of will. It is bestowed upon us.
And that is the whole relationship we all really have to the creation, but have lost touch with often.
But a gift revives the soul.
I would say so.
And it not only moves with a rhythm, it moves in a circle.
Can you say more about that?
The gift keeps giving if it's honored. And that was the purpose of the whole ceremony and the self-discipline and the gratitude that was modeled by the leadership and honored by the parents and the grandparents and the great-grandparents. And so the children grew up in this culture.
There you go, right.
Of the circular continuity that went on for thousands of years.
And the reciprocity. Yeah.
So you started learning about sacredness outside the classroom.
Yeah, after 4 years of studying religion and not really believing anything, you know, my eyes were opened.
And so on the plains with the Lakota and along the Columbia, did your heart begin to dance with these people?
I believe it did. That's a one way of expressing it.
Had that ever happened in the classroom?
Not in that way, although I had some incredibly wonderful professors.
I know you did.
Who sometimes got us moved and moving, yes.
Good. This is KDNK, and you're listening to a Living World conversation with Barbara Dills about the salmon run of the Columbia River. Although your heart is dancing, is it also not heavy as you look at the world today and the reality of what's happened to the Columbia River?
Well, you know, I think one of the things I probably learned that has been the most sustaining for me in my own life, that I learned from my Lakota family and then again from the people I got close to, the what we call the river people along the Columbia, is that one can and kind of must hold the heavy thing right along with the joy and celebration and dancing. And I think it's one reason why the healing that's going on in Indian communities right now is so profound, because I think they're getting back more of that joy and celebration and gratitude, peace, in tied to their traditions, their cultural traditions, to balance all that their people have been through and even their own families and children. And so I think that's part of how they are healing as communities, is that there's more attention, more opportunity, more outlets for the lighter side of things, for the really sustaining hope and positive generation. And they, I'm sure people have heard this expression, the seven generations, but among the people that I've worked with on Rosebud in the last 10, 13 years, always attention is given to how will the decisions we make today affect our generation, seven generations down the line. And that almost insists that you have something to give and pass along that is joyous and celebratory. Otherwise, why would you pass it along? So that's the balance, I think, to all the heaviness. And so I feel like that has really helped me in my own life to try to maintain that sort of a perspective.
And when we talked last year, you read the proclamation of the Sichanga people and Rosebud. It was very much that way.
Yeah, they're just doing amazing things as a community, despite, you know, all the challenges and lack of funds and everything else that they face.
So the ceremonial leader of this first food, this salmon ceremony, was altruistic in how respect was communicated and the need of collective support for honoring the salmon.
Right, and it really wasn't just one leader. There were always a group of leaders. And the religion, if you want to name it that, that the tradition that accompanied the Salila Longhouse is called the Seven Drums religion. And usually there are seven drums. So there was never like one leader. There were elders, respected elders, who kind of led that ceremony.
Yeah. Thank you. I think that's important to emphasize. And it was a collective commitment to wisdom.
And to wisdom as lived, I think, you know.
Well, wisdom in the relationship of maintaining the balance between people and salmon and the water.
Yes.
Do you believe wisdom traveled up and down the Columbia River?
You mean in terms of the sharing of different traditions, or?
There was a lot of overlap and meeting of different tribes, because a tribe would have an area that they fished, but they had a neighbor they knew upstream and downstream, communication, and reached some kind of level of cooperation that I would call wisdom.
Okay, there we go. I understand now what... well, yeah, and there were four tribes that actually were a part of the treaty of, let's see, I think it was 1855. Yep. The 1855 treaty is what granted Native people in the Northwest the right to fish at all their usual, quote, usual and accustomed places. And the four tribes that are listed on that treaty are the Yakima, the Umatilla, the Nez Perce, and the Warm Springs. And those are the four tribal or cultural units, if you will, that all utilize the Columbia River, even if their main center of life was further away. For example, Warm Springs were traditionally more from, you know, south of the Columbia in what is now Oregon, and the Yakima and the Umatilla were both north of the river in what is now Washington. And the Nez Perce kind of spanned both sides of the river, but were further upriver.
Right.
Yeah. But all four of those tribes are listed in that treaty.
Right.
As being granted those rights. And so for many generations, even after the treaty, yeah, people would migrate down to the river during the summer and harvest fish. And yes, they did have kind of assumed designated, there were no signs up, but they had
right.
areas that they respected that were traditional for certain families or tribal groups.
Right. And the commitment to this way of life was strong.
Very strong.
And the culture of wisdom was strong, in contrast to a culture of anger or greed or insecurity. There was enough strength to stand in the stature of collective fierce love and wisdom.
Well, and I think, you know, that strength partly came from the fact that there was always plenty to eat because of how the natural world provided and the reciprocity of those peoples to not take more than they needed and to honor it. And so I think when people have enough provided by the natural world, that's a strong foundation. And that was true of the Plains people in terms of the buffalo. It gave them their food, their clothing, their utensils, everything really that they needed. And then the horse helped them move around to follow the buffalo. So
recognizing how much is enough is a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Something we haven't learned all that well as a civilization. One of the things that I was really privileged to experience when I lived along the river was I did get to know people who lived at Celilo and became my friends. And I also got to know the elder, David So Happy, not a lot personally, but he did grant me a conversation at his home once, probably around 84. Anyway, it was before he was incarcerated for ostensibly selling salmon out of season. But just to back up a little bit, there's a famous, I think the whole fishing rights struggle is very instructive. And there's a, you know, a famous decision that came down in 1969 called the Bologna decision. And it was based on the case So Happy versus Smith. And So Happy was David So Happy representing, he was the named plaintiff representing 14 members of the Yakima Indian Nation, his people. And they sued the state of Oregon over its imposed regulation of their fishing access along the Columbia River. The Columbia River, for those that aren't familiar with the geography, that part of the river bisects or defines the border between Oregon and Washington. So the southern side of the river is all Oregon controlled, the northern side Washington controlled. So in terms of the fish and wildlife regulations, they have varied on the two sides of the river, which also has been very confusing. But in this case, David So Happy as the named plaintiff and 13 of his fellow Yakima tribal members sued the state of Oregon, and Smith happened to have been the head of their fish regulatory. And in this decision, the Indians basically said, no, the treaty of 1855 protected our right to fish in our usual and accustomed places. So the state has no right to tell us we can't fish here or there if those were our traditional fishing sites. And Judge Bologna sided with the Indians, and they prevailed in that case.
Thank you, Barbara. Do you think you'd come back and talk to us more about David So Happy and Celilo?
I would love to do that.
Okay. This is KDNK, and you've been listening to a Living World conversation with Barbara Dills about the Columbia River Salmon Run. Thank you for listening. Yeah.